Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yep.
And NPR.
Hello there. This is Jim Dixon speaking.
Hello, Dr. Dixon. My name is Soren.
Soren.
Yeah, I'm the producer for today. You'll actually be talking to our host, Jad. He's on his way over to the studios right now. So
that's good.
All right, so let's just start the story here. This is a bit of tape we've had for a while. It's just kind of fun. It'll lead into the story in a second.
Hello, Dr. Dixon.
Hello there, Jad.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm always pleased to talk about my delightful obsession that I've had for more than 10 years
well,
that led to my marriage to a French lady. I'm not joking.
How does the marriage to the French lady factor in?
Ah, well, we met on email.
Huh.
A bit like You've Got Mail, you know, the Hollywood film.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, my wife was... My wife is sitting beside me, and she's making signals. Well, what is it you're saying, dear?
Could I ask
Yes.
Is there any chance we could talk to your wife? If she's sitting right next there.
Yes.
Next to you. Okay.
I want to talk to you, dear.
Oh, yeah. With my bad English.
Come on.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Sorry, I am French and my English is not very excellent.
No, you're fantastic. bonjour.
Bonjour.
He mentioned that Utsi was what brought you together.
Yes, it's true. I was a teacher, a primary school teacher.
She emailed me some questions about Utsi.
Yes.
And I answered them to the best of my ability. And shortly after, we were married.
Yes.
No kidding. So,
Utsi is my benefactor, my friend.
Okay, so we should introduce ourselves real fast. I'm Jad.
I am Robert.
This is Radiolab. So that guy, Jim Dixon, I believe he's a botanist.
Yeah.
Called him 4 years ago to talk about this fellow Utsi. We're going to tell Utsi's story completely in just a second. But there's something in the whole interaction between him and his wife there that just kind of captures how everybody gets when they get into Utsi. They either get married or they get obsessed.
Yeah, but it wasn't until very recently. Our producer, Andy Mills, and I happened to talk to this graphic artist named Aaron Burke, who is also totally obsessed with this guy, Utsi.
Yes, yeah. I think there's this hunger on the part of the reason.
That's when we really understood what this story is all about.
Yeah, I mean, at least for me, that's where it all started.
And since Andy's been reporting this piece, why don't, Andy, you just take the ball from here?
Okay.
Do it, Andy.
So, story starts 1991. Way up in the Alps.
At 3,210 meters above sea level. I know you Americans don't think in meters. That's roughly 10,500 feet.
This is a frozen glacial spot. And up there, walking around, were
two hill walkers.
Two hill walkers. Hikers.
Hikers, aye. It was a German couple, a man and wife.
It was early in the afternoon.
And
at some point,
they take a notion to head off trail.
And they were only 100 yards off the beaten track.
And after just a few minutes, they round a little rock, and that's when they were stopped dead in their tracks.
By what?
By a corpse.
This corpse sticking out of the ice. He was lying on his stomach.
Face down in the ice.
He was kind of draped over a big boulder.
His legs are buried under the ice up to his hips, and his top half is just sticking out. His left arm is kind of under his forehead, almost like a schoolboy falling asleep in class on his arm. So these two hikers, they see this and they run off for help.
They hot-footed it to the nearby mountain hut, thinking it was a mountaineering accident.
A recent one.
And they called the police.
They said, hey, somebody, a tourist or a climber, had some sort of accident. And so the cops showed up with drills and ice picks and started to chip away at the ice, trying to get the body out. But then, I started noticing some things. Like, this guy had all these tattoos.
On his back and behind his knees.
And then they start noticing all this stuff buried with him.
He's got some kind of moccasin, looks like ox skin.
He had a bearskin cap.
Unusual stuff.
He had a copper-headed, U-hafted axe.
A what?
A small pouch filled with medicinal tree fungus.
Really?
A quiver full of arrows. A longbow.
He had grass socks.
Grass socks?
Mm-hmm. Woven grass.
A dagger that has been chipped out of stone.
And so these cops realize
that this is not a 20th century tourist who wandered off trail.
This was something extraordinary.
This is old.
Like Renaissance or old Middle Ages or old...
Well, wouldn't we like to know?
And what did the police do?
Well, the police reported it to the forensic authorities in the University of Innsbruck.
Basically, they took it to a team of local scientists who sent samples out to a bunch of labs and eventually confirmed that, yeah, this is old. But not just old. This was really old. This body is 5,300 years old.
Wow.
Yes.
That's way before Jesus, way before Moses.
If you were to use as a historic mark point, let's say the pyramids of Egypt, this would be 700 years prior to the construction of the pyramid in Giza.
It was beyond archaeologists' wildest dreams. A 5,200-year-old perfectly preserved corpse.
We're talking about a man with all his skin, with his eyeballs, his teeth, his tongue, his groin, his organs, his guts, everything's in there. Everything is almost perfectly freeze-dried.
There he is.
Wow.
So what does he look like?
Oh, well, he was bearded.
He's 45 years old, which I think for 3000 BC is pretty darn old.
Huh.
And he was a small guy. He was only about 5'2" in height.
But his calf muscles, his thigh muscles are incredibly developed.
Yeah.
So this would suggest that he's a hunter or a shepherd of some kind who walks these mountains.
His physique is comparable to a modern Olympian wrestler. He's very obviously a human being. Very, very obviously, and he would have had all the hopes and fears of you and I.
They even gave him a name.
Utsi.
Etsy, Ertsy, Utsi.
Even though some of us can't really pronounce that name.
Otsi.
Spell it.
O with two dots on top.
Scientists call him Utsi.
There's all kinds of drama. There's Austria competing with Italy. He's our mummy. No, he's our mummy. He's on the border. Whose mummy is he?
Eventually, the Italians got him.
Because he's said to be 92 meters inside Italy.
a whole museum is built around him. An entire facility is built to freeze him. There's teams of researchers. There's competing universities. You have documentaries. You have books and articles about this incredible mummy who was walking in the ice. He fell. Isn't that fascinating?
You know Brad Pitt?
Yeah.
He got a tattoo of Otzi on his arm.
Really?
But what everyone really wanted to know was...
Who was this prehistoric person?
Who was this guy?
Where did he come from?
Was he a scout? Was he a traveler?
Where was he going?
How did he fall?
How had he died?
Was it a storm that took him?
And what was he doing so high in the mountains?
Yeah. But when we found him, there really wasn't any way to answer these kinds of questions. All you got was wild speculation. But this is where it becomes more than a story about an ancient dead guy. Over the past, 22 years since he's been found, all these researchers keep coming back to Otzi. And they've gathered just enough little pieces of evidence that when you put it all together, what you get is this surprisingly intimate look at this one real person, like this one real dude who lived 5,300 years ago. And for our purposes, the first piece of that puzzle falls into place on a summer's day in 2001 when a radiologist named
Dr. Paul Gossner is staring at a CT scan.
Basically a 3D x-ray of Otzi's chest.
Maybe for the umpteenth time, for the thousandth time.
When suddenly...
he notices something unusual.
Right up by Otzi's shoulder blade.
In the left scapula.
What does he notice?
He finds an arrowhead. lodged in the shoulder blade. And I think it was hard to see because it's stone, not metal. If it was metal, they would have picked it up right away.
So does this mean that this is like a possible murder?
That's right. The whole thing blows up to a full-scale murder mystery.
From that moment on, we knew that he was shot with an arrow, and then it all started the research about...
That's Albert Zink. He's actually the top scientist in charge of OTSI these days.
What we do is like doing a crime scene investigation. We try to put together...
Not too long after Gossner spotted that arrowhead, Zink and his team, they take OTSI. They actually put him into an ambulance, rush him as fast as they can to a hospital, trying to make sure that he doesn't thaw, and they put him into a higher resolution, full body CT scan.
And... The plot thickens further. We find severe abdominal wounds and rib fractures.
Things that before may have come across as 5,000-year-old wear and tear.
There's an orbital fracture of the cranium.
Now it's like we're seeing them with new eyes.
His head is busted.
And not only that.
His right palm is very badly cut. It's very deep.
How deep?
It's so deep that there's cuts in the underlying bones.
Oh.
And some pathologists say it's a defensive wound.
A wound that comes from a fight.
He held his right hand up and he got slashed on his right palm.
And in trying to piece together what happened, one of the questions that scientists like Albert Zink asked was like, this cut on his hand, was it a...
fresh wound or this was already a healing wound?
Like how much time had passed between when he got the cut and when he died?
Well, we took a little tissue piece out of the wound.
They rehydrated it. They sliced it up with lasers.
We made little slices and we have a look at them in the microscope.
And they could see evidence that when he died, the blood from this wound was just starting to clot. But that it had not yet formed a scab when he died, which told them that this attack...
This must be a wound that happened already 3 or 4 days before he died.
Which added another question to the list. Like, what happened in those last 3 or 4 days between the time he got cut and the time he died?
Well, I mean, I think this is the most fascinating thing of all about Utsi.
Jim told us, luckily for scientists...
His intestines are all there.
And to the trained eye, your intestines...
It's like a map and a diary.
A diary?
Yeah, a diary.
In what way?
If there's any food... in your stomach, it's less than 4 hours old.
Which would probably be your last meal.
And the stuff in an intermediate position, like the colon, is between a few hours old and a few days old.
Your last few meals.
So if you get samples from all these and look at the contents, you can deduce all sorts of things.
But one small problem. If you've got a 5,000-year-old mummy on your hands, you can't exactly just cut him open. So Jim and his team, what they did is they snaked some fancy equipment up his butt and started rooting around.
I mean, I didn't do that, you appreciate. I'm a botanist, I'm not a medic.
Someone else from his team did that. In any case, they got up in there, and first of all, they couldn't find the stomach. But they did pull out samples from the rest of his guts, and they found...
Pollen.
Actually, two kinds of pollen. One from...
from the fresh flowers of the hop hornbeam.
Yes.
A tree that blooms down in the valley. And...
conifer pollen.
A second kind of pollen from high-altitude evergreen trees.
So you've got the high mountain firs...
yes.
And the deciduous trees of the valley, of the low places. You've got the hornbeam.
Both of these kinds of pollen were found in Otsi's gut. Probably because he drank some water which contained the pollen, but here's the key. The pollen from the valley... it's sandwiched in between these two layers of mountain pollen, and that implies an order. Otsi must have first ingested the pine pollen, then the hornbeam, and then the pine pollen again, and that suggests...
about 2 days or so before he died, he was high up in the hills...
drinking pollen-laden water high above...
and then he was very low down below the tree line...
drinking pollen-laden water down below...
and then he came back up again to meet his end.
And so, taking all that and a couple other pieces of research, here is what we think happened to Otsi in his last days. We know that it would have been summertime.
Probably June.
Because that hornbeam pollen in his gut?
Only blooms in the early summertime, in June.
And for whatever reason...
maybe he's hunting, maybe he's looking for copper, we don't know. But we do know...
he's high up in the mountains, right?
Well above the tree line.
And then he goes back down to his village.
Which we believe was south of the mountain. because certain chemicals in the local water were also found in Ötzi's teeth and bones. Anyway, it was not a short walk home.
It's a long way down. It's 5,000-6,000 feet we're talking about.
Then we know that within the span of about 24 hours...
something happens in his village.
Something violent.
Maybe his people were fighting with other people where he got...
The details are a little blurry, but it is clear that he was attacked, that he put his right hand up to defend himself, and that he gets that cut.
It's very deep, it's very bloody, it's very painful. And shortly after that event, he bends down and picks up a clump of bog moss.
Jim actually found that bog moss on Ötzi, and he says that it's...
it's mildly antiseptic.
Anyway, Ötzi, he heads back up the mountain.
He goes back up again, perhaps pursued by somebody or people, plural.
We think that maybe he was in a hurry because...
of the 14 arrows...
that he was carrying.
Only 2 had flint tips and feathers, and the other 12 were useless.
Which suggests a frantic state. I mean, you've got a guy who's running, bleeding, and he's busily carving his arrows.
Carving as he runs, and for about a day...
or maybe a day and a half.
He's running a lot. Like, we know that he runs over 12 miles, that he gets up above 10,000 feet above sea level, managing to evade whoever it is that's coming after him. But then...
the fatal arrow shot.
This is the official report from the South Tyrol Museum of Archaeology. We can see that the point of the arrow tore a hole in the artery beneath his left collarbone, which led to a massive hematoma, which bled into the thorax cavity, which in turn caused cardiac arrest and sudden death.
He bled to death.
He would have died in less than half an hour.
Really?
He would have died in 20 minutes, perhaps.
And according to a lot of researchers, whoever killed Ötzi came over, pulled the arrow shaft out of Ötzi's back, picked up a big stone, and bashed his head in. And then, within about an hour, maybe two, his body would have been completely covered in snow. Then within a month or so, that snow would have become ice. And then, when the next summer came around, that ice would have thawed out just enough to allow a little sunlight to come through. The next winter, he would have froze again. Following summer, thawed a little bit, and then froze again, and then thawed. And here's why that's important. Bodies that are completely frozen deteriorate. Those periods of thaw kept him from deteriorating. So you had this perfect mixture throughout all these years. A season of snow, a season of ice, and then a thaw, and then a snow, and then an ice, and then a thaw. I mean, just think about it. Year in and year out. And then the snow, and then the ice. Throughout the building of the pyramids, the rise and fall of Rome, the Enlightenment, the Industrial Revolution. All of this time, Ötzi was there. In that spot, just a few feet away from where he was murdered. Until 1991, when a couple of German hikers decided to head off trail.
We have forensic proof of his suffering. We have forensic proof of his hunger. We have forensic evidence that he was cold. I mean, we have all of this undeniable, irrefutable forensic evidence that this man was a living human being who was tormented and was enduring with incredible tenacity.
And in the last few years, scientists have still been at it. They've still been poking at Ötzi, trying to figure out who was this guy. Not just who might he have been, but who was he really?
I think there's a hope that something will be found which will say, yes, he was a hero. Yes, he was a king. Yes, he was a father. I think there's this hunger on the part of the researchers to find something beyond the biology, beyond the molecular chemistry, to find some sense of the humanity.
And in the years since we spoke with Jim Dixon, scientists did find something, which for Aaron at least does give him that sense.
In 2010,
they found Ötzi's stomach, which Jim and his team, they couldn't find because it was
tucked deep up under his rib cage, pressed up against his heart. They find the stomach.
And inside,
1.5 pounds of undigested goat meat and bread in his belly.
His last meal.
This was eaten on the day of his death.
Maybe just an hour before he died.
It was a huge feast.
And for Aaron, imagining Otzi sitting at that fire right before he died, that's what did it.
Oh, I can see it. He's eating. He cooked his food. We have proof. He cooked the meat and he sat down. It must have taken time. It took at least an hour or two. Like, I can feel it. I'm in the cave. I'm by the fire.
That's what brought him back.
So you're saying then that some hours before, he had somehow the time to build a fire, catch or acquire or carry a fairly substantial meal and sit and eat it, somewhat at rest. So he must not have known what was coming was coming.
Maybe he knew. Maybe he had found some kind of resolution around it. But we have forensic proof that for this brief moment in time, the Alpine Iceman felt safe enough to stew his meat and his bread and sit by the fire and eat his dinner.
A friend of the show, a novelist named Stefan Block, he heard about this guy Otzi, got obsessed, but unlike Brad Pitt, instead of getting a tattoo, he wrote a fictional piece that tries to answer some of those remaining questions, like, why was Otzi pursued? Who was after him? Why'd they kill him?
All I could remember were the fear and running that were mine alone. The blood in my hand that no other hand came to nurse. And at last, the relief of spilling myself back into the snow and stone of our forever mountain.
The story, it's this beautiful imagining of what it would be like if Otzi were to just wake up today. What he might remember about his life and his death, what the world, our world, might look like and feel like to him.
The place they called streets were great edged canyons, a person in every tiny cave. These are called buildings, they told me. We make them for people to live and work. Our new valley, called City, was so big. The scientist people explained that we were not just this valley city. We were thousands of cities big, thousands of cities, and a great blue stone called Earth, which was only like a little bead in a place called the universe, where the stars threaded millions of these globes like bracelets. But I could not think a pride as big as this universe, and I asked them to stop their stories.
You can find that piece, along with a look at some of Otzi's tattoos and a lot of other really great stuff, on our website, radiolab.org. And of course, thanks for listening.
This is Bonnie calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic, but you don't have to be, because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Hey, Lulu here. You asked, and we listened. He wanted a Zuzve shirt, and we made one. It is a gorgeous celebration of the liminal being that is Venus's moon slash not moon. And you yourself can sport this homage to the unknowable multitudes of those all around you and within you by simply joining The Lab. The Lab is our membership program. That is the place where we fight the fight against the fickle whims of the economy to make our show protected from all that based on listener support. If you sign up, we thank you with the brand new Zuzve t-shirt and also ad-free episodes, bonus interviews, and other swaggy stuff like stickers and patches. You can go check out the perks and see if it's right for you by going to radiolab.org/join. And thank you, either way, for being here, for listening to our show. We make it for you, Zve. Anyway, radiolab.org/join. Check it out, and thanks.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
And today we are talking about...
really, really, really old things, mysteries, old stories that start a long, long time ago.
And now... story about a thing.
It's in this vault.
It lives inside a steel vault, inside this huge laboratory, at Wits University in Johannesburg, South Africa. We asked a professor there, Dr. Bernard Zepfel, to pull it out and show it to our reporter, Patricia Hume.
And this is the original specimen. This is it. This, we have it right in front of us here. I mean, I handle this a lot, but I get goose flesh every time I take this out.
The reason it gives him goose flesh, or goosebumps, is because this object seems to completely upend two basic questions about, you know, human history.
Amazing.
Where did we begin? And when we began, who was trying to take us out?
Producer Andy Mills takes the story from here.
Right.
With thunder and vigor.
And gusto.
With gusto.
Ooh, yes, I'd like to with gusto, please.
All right.
Well, it's one of those discoveries that almost didn't happen.
And here to help me tell you the story...
okay, I'm Professor Lee Berger.
Is Lee.
I am a research professor at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg and an explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society.
An explorer in residence. That's a weird title. It seems like you shouldn't... you should be one or the other.
It's almost an oxymoron, isn't it?
Yeah.
Lee says that our story begins back in the 1920s in South Africa at a place called...
Tong.
Tong.
It's T-A-N-U-G. Taung is the proper way in Tswana. The Western way of saying is Tong. It's a desert area on the southern edge of the Kalahari Escarpment.
Kind of like your stereotypical picture of Africa.
Red rocks, baobab trees, roaming gazelles.
And back in the 1920s...
the place was crawling with Europeans... digging mines.
They were blasting away with dynamite, drilling with big steam drills, and huge explosions would take place.
And one day these miners, they're blowing their way through a bit of this hillside, and as the rock falls away and the smoke clears, they realize that they've opened up this cave.
An ancient cave. And inside of that cave...
they found dozens of these strange-looking rocks, almost like animal bones. One of the miners, he takes those bones, gives them to a geologist.
Geologist boxed them up.
And sent them to this Australian guy who is living in Johannesburg named Raymond Dart.
And that's probably the first miracle in this story. Raymond Dart was a neuroanatomist, a comparative neuroanatomist, one of the only ones in the world.
This was a guy who knew his fossils. And when this box arrived, he was actually wearing a three-piece suit.
He's going to be best man at a wedding, in fact, later that afternoon.
But he's like, that can wait. So he reached into the box, shuffled through some antelope skulls.
It was full of baboon skulls.
Monkey skulls, until he got to this one rock. Now, to you or me, this would have just looked like a big chunk of limestone.
But Raymond Dart immediately realized that he had something special. And he actually went and got his wife's knitting needles and started scratching away at this rock, much to his wife's disgust. He then spent the next several months
delicately chipping away at the limestone until...
the rock literally popped free. And there he stared into a perfect little face.
You can see here, the face is quite flat and human-like.
A lot like the face...
of a child.
A human child.
But humans have a larger brain.
According to Dr. Zepfeld, this child's brain was smaller than a human child. It was closer to the size
of a chimpanzee.
So it had features of a human, it had a brain more like a chimpanzee's. Stranger still, Dart, who, remember, studied this sort of thing, he looked at the foramen magnum.
That's the hole in the base of your skull where your spine goes in.
He knew that for creatures that walk on four legs, that hole
is generally towards the back of the skull, so they can look forward.
But here, the hole is on the bottom, which suggested to him that this creature walked upright.
It was not a monkey. It wasn't an ape as we know apes today. It was certainly not a modern human being.
This was something in between.
If you were walking across a broken woodland where little Tong Chao might have lived, you would have seen a person off in the distance. As you approached, though, you'd begin to see that something was wrong with the proportions. Arms were probably a little longer, legs a little bit shorter, the head was too small.
And as you stepped closer, you'd see
the little Tong Chao's body would have been covered in
this thick hair.
Potentially even fur, more like an ape than we have. But it would be like no ape you've ever seen, because it would be standing there in very much the way you would be standing staring at it on two legs.
So if this is a little bit human and a little bit ape, sort of kind of in the middle, it seems, did he feel like this was the, quote, missing link?
Well, we don't use that term because evolution doesn't happen that way.
Sure.
But certainly Dart did. He in fact wrote a book called Adventures with the Missing Link.
And right after he discovered the skull,
he sent a paper off in amazing speed to the journal Nature. It was published in February of 1925.
He thought that this was going to revolutionize everything.
But he was wholeheartedly rejected by the great scientific community of Europe for two reasons.
First,
we already knew that humans didn't evolve in Africa.
Yeah, Africa was backward.
That was the belief, says Chris Stringer.
I'm a research leader in human origins at the Natural History Museum in London.
And he explained that back in the early 20th century,
people of the time felt that if you look in Europe, you can see all this wonderful cave art painted many thousands of years ago. They preferred to think that Europe or Asia were more likely centers of our origins than Africa was.
Second, scientists already found a skull that they believed belonged to the quote-unquote missing link.
Was something called Piltdown Man.
It was this ancient man fossil thing that they found in a golf course in England, so in their minds it was the right place. And also,
in Piltdown Man, you've got this very large brain and a brain case that looks really quite like a modern human one.
Which made sense to them. You know, clearly European ancestors would have had big brains because they're European.
Yeah. I mean, the Tong individual had a small brain.
Way too small.
This thing was too primitive. It didn't look right.
So Dart?
He spent the next 20 plus years
arguing, look, people, this is our ancestor, and getting nowhere.
Until,
in the late 1920s,
other fossils started showing up.
In China, South Africa, Kenya, Ethiopia.
And these other fossils, they were from roughly the same era as the Piltdown Man. But their brains, their teeth, their bone structures, they were all totally different.
So this was very weird. I mean, how do you explain that?
For decades,
nothing else like Piltdown Man turns up from anywhere in the world.
So some forensic experts at the London Museum of Natural History, they decide, maybe we ought to go take a closer look at Piltdown Man.
They started looking at the material under microscopes.
And right off the bat,
they found that one of the teeth clearly showed the marks of a metal file. That it had been filed down to look flat.
No.
Piltdown was a fraud. It was a fake.
A forgery, a hoax.
And the hoaxsters were never caught.
There were questions in the Houses of Parliament about the competence of the Natural History Museum, that its experts had been fooled for all this time.
Because this wasn't even a very good fake.
They had taken the jawbone of an orangutan. They took some modern human skull pieces. They then stained that material dark brown, so it looked the same color.
No.
They even faked stone tools.
And all this time, right there in front of them, was the Tong Child.
It is estimated, and it's purely an estimate, of being around 2.2 million years old.
Which, still today, is the oldest, not quite yet human fossil that we have.
This would be probably the greatest, or one of the greatest, discoveries ever.
Been argued to be the most important single fossil ever discovered in the history of humankind's search for ancestry, because
it brought to the fore that humanity originated in Africa. That every human on Earth is an African. We are all of African origin.
But, more than just where we came from, which I think is totally cool.
Yeah, super interesting.
Mm-hmm. We can look at the skull and we can see things about, you know, what life was like for this like little version of us that lived so long ago. We look at the teeth, we can see what it was eating.
Was it eating like what we eat?
Yeah, its teeth are like surprisingly similar to our teeth. So yeah, it wasn't like hugely different from what we eat. But I think the most exciting thing that it can tell us is, you know, not just about what our life was like, but what was lurking in the shadows waiting to take us out.
You can tell that from this skull?
Yeah, I mean, this skull is, it's kind of at the center of this murder mystery.
I.e., who killed the Tong Chao? At the time when Raymond Dart made that discovery,
he had this sort of gut feeling that this Tong Chao was killed by one of its own. You know, because this is like 1924.
We were between two wars. World War One had occurred with the horrible destruction.
Dart was actually a medic in that war, and he walked away convinced
that humans were inherently evil creatures.
That were inherently violent, and that we were probably a lot worse in the past.
And in fact, the opening of 2001 A Space Odyssey,
where you see the monkeys kind of like beating each other with the bones,
was based on Raymond Dart's theories of the violent origins on the continent of Africa.
So that was Dart's like pet theory, that maybe Tong got clubbed down by his brother or his neighbor. But that ignores one big thing. In that limestone mine where the Tong skull was found, there were also all these other skulls. Baboon skulls, monkey skulls. There was this like little collection of bones. More like what you would expect to find in a predator's den. So not a Tong-like creature, but maybe a cat. Big cat.
At least a large mammalian predator, then, because that's perfectly acceptable. If we're tough, they're tough, it's okay to be killed by something mean and vicious.
So that became the new theory.
Because what else do humans have to fear, right?
Well, what? Now, here's where I think maybe you come into the story. For some reason, when you arrive many, many, many years later, this idea that the cat did it seems to disturb you.
Well, I was addicted to that story as anyone else. I'd been brought up on it through my anthropology classes. Every book I ever read said that.
But one day,
In 1994,
he bumps into a completely new idea.
In an almost eureka moment. Because there I was at Gladysville,
an excavation site in South Africa. Lee and his team were doing what they do, digging for fossils.
I just finished excavation, all my team had left, and I was sitting there watching the sunset. And I looked up on the hillside, and there was a troop of vervet monkeys. They were a small gray monkey. And they were coming down to forage down the hill. And all of a sudden, I heard an alarm call. And I looked up in the sky, and there came a huge eagle. The monkeys scattered as this eagle swooped around the edge of the hill. And as it came down around the edge of the hill, I realized it was a trap. Because coming around the other edge of the hill was that eagle's mate. And it zoomed in and whacked one of those large monkeys right in front of me. And everything went silent. The other eagle landed, this eagle sitting on top of a now dead monkey, and the eagle's staring at me. I'm staring at it, probably with my mouth open. It looks at me for a moment, and then it leaps off the edge of this cliff with this dead monkey and flies away with it down the valley. And I had an idea. So I got into my car, I chased the direction it went, I knew where it was going, I knew where these black eagle nests were, they were up on a cliff face, I crawled up under, crossing a river, crawled up under the nest, and there was this pile of bones, huge pile of bones, hyraxes, little antelopes, a baboon skull, a baby baboon skull, and almost every one of the bones there had these amazing marks on them. Keyhole-shaped cuts.
Where the eagles have driven their talons into the skulls.
These big eagles can have killing talons that are 5, 6, 7 inches long, if you can imagine that. I got in my car, back to the lab in Joburg.
He whips open the drawer that contains those skulls and bones that were found with the Tong Chao skull. And
the exact same marks. Couldn't believe it.
There's even, like, a little mark on the Tong Child skull itself. A year later, 1995, he and a colleague, they publish a paper
that blamed eagles for the death of the Tong Child. And it was received like a smelly, wet blanket by the field.
Why would they not say, oh, of course?
Because it was an entrenched idea.
You know, Lee says maybe subconsciously they felt like our ancestors are being demoted again.
That is that, you know, we were not the masters of our universe.
Because cats just feel tougher than birds? I don't know. But according to Lee, the big cat scientists were like,
you know, it's been published. It's been published a leopard did it.
For 40 years.
We even got into a debate in the hallowed pages of the journal Nature on the load-lifting capacity of birds of prey, on whether or not birds of prey could lift something as large as the Tong Child.
And these debates, they went on for years. He couldn't convince people.
We needed something more.
Until one night.
It was about 9 o'clock at night.
Years later.
I was at home sitting in my little study.
He was reading an academic paper about eagles and how eagles sometimes, when they kill little mammals, they'll reach into their eye sockets and pluck out their eyes.
To get at the nice, juicy brain on the inside.
And in the paper,
there was this really beautiful image. Well, it's beautiful to people who study dead things, but a beautiful image of a skull of a primate with the interior sockets of its eyes with these jagged marks in it.
These very particular scratch marks on the underside of the eye sockets.
And I was staring at these images, and I went, oh my goodness, or something to that effect. I got into my car, drove down to the lab, opened up the safe, pulled out the Tong Child, turned the face over, and there they were. On the base of the inside of the eye socket were these jagged, rigid marks that you had to have done by reaching into the orbit. The exact same marks.
You can see little squiggle marks, almost like little exclamation marks and little commas. No one had noticed that before.
And imagine, I'm sitting in the middle of this anatomy department, in the middle of the night, in a vault containing million-year-old fossils. It was a magic moment. It was fantastic.
All right, so now you know a little bit about how this creature lived and how it died. I mean, beyond solving the murder mystery, what does that tell you?
Well, first to say, solving the murder mystery is kind of cool. That's always a neat thing.
Totally.
And there's nothing wrong with just doing that. But have you ever thought why, when you're standing out on a playground or standing out in an open field and a shadow passes over you, do you know that feeling that occurred, whether it be from an airplane or whatever? First, you get that tingly feel on the back of your neck and then you yank your head up. You ever wondered why you do that?
Yeah.
You do that because the little Tong Child died 2.5 million years ago because he didn't look up quick enough when that happened.
Producer Annie Mills. One thing we should say, one very important thing we should say, is actually we did an experiment with the story. Mm. We hooked up with some people at MakerBot and some very nice folks at the Field Museum
in Chicago.
And we had 3D scans made of the Tong Child skull. I'm actually holding one right now.
Me too, yeah. Mine's purple.
Mine's pink.
Why is yours pink?
Oh. I don't know. That was the color of the plastic they used. Okay. But these are amazing replicas of the Tong Child skull. I mean, you can see all the ridges. You can feel the scratches and the eyes.
Imagine if you could listen to the story you just heard while holding the Tong Child in your hand.
Well, that's exactly the reason we did this.
We
have partnered with a museum called Museum. That's spelled with 4 M's, 2 in the front, 2 in the back. Museum. It's this tiny little elevator shaft-sized place here in Manhattan where they display all these sort of, like, oddities, you know, like little objects from Saddam Hussein's palace.
They have pool toys that were banned from Saudi Arabia.
Right. And they will also be displaying our 3D replica of the Tong skull. So if you go there, you can actually hold the skull, you dial in a little number, and you can hear part of the piece.
While you're standing there.
Yeah, and I gotta tell you, it's a very different experience to listen to the story while holding this thing. Not only that, if you have a 3D printer of your own, and you go to radiolab.org, you can download a scan, a 3D scan of the Tong skull, and you can print your own. Thanks again to MakerBot and to Shoot Digital for helping to make that happen. Props to Lynn Levy for conceiving of the whole idea. Go to our website, radiolab.org.
By the way, Lee Berger, who just helped us with that piece, has just come up with a monster new discovery in a cave in South Africa. It seems to have been a kind of ceremonial, it's not a burial ground, but it had a little crack 7.5 inches wide. Six scientists slipped through, working for Lee Berger, discovered all kinds of bones. Those creatures are about 3 million years old. They're 5 foot tall, 100-pound, kind of charming-looking hominids. You want to check them out? We've got one waiting for you at radiolab.org.
And we're going to go to break now, but stay tuned, because when we get back, we're going to take a deep, and I mean deep, dive into...
Really into the history of everything. Everything that was, is, has ever been, all the way back.
Exactly. This is the history of everything. Coming up next, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Stay with us.
Hi, this is Lauren from Atlanta, Georgia. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, I'm Jad.
I'm Robert.
And this is Radiolab. And today...
we're looking back in time.
Yeah, we started with the mystery of Utsi the Iceman. So.
That's a 5,000-year-old story, right?
Yes.
With murder, indeed. Frozen mummy, arrowhead.
Etc. And then we went 2.5 million years back, so farther back still, to the mystery of the Tong child and the little skull.
Now, a huge leap. We go from 2.5 million years ago to something like 14 billion years ago.
Yeah, this is the very oldest thing in the universe.
It's really probably the oldest story we can tell. It is the history
of everything.
Yeah, and we're going to start with...
Hello, hello, hello.
Hi.
Hi. Is this Jenny by any chance?
It sure is.
Hey. Her name's Jenny Hollowell. She's a writer, an author, and...
good, thanks.
Here's the setup. So we were recently asked by the show Selected Shorts to curate an evening of stories, just to select a couple for people to read. Well, that turned out to be really hard for us. Like, we could not agree. We argued. It got kind of ugly internally. I'm not going to go there. But the one story that we all agreed on instantly.
And we never really looked back.
Yeah. Was a story from Jenny Hollowell called A History of Everything, Including You. So we called her up, and we asked her to...
Well, I kind of gushed a little first.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was the fawning.
There was the falling. I mean, I know that people are going to hear this, so they're not going to read it, so they won't be able to dwell on just the incredible tensions in these very short and specific sentences that you've written. But I'm just wondering, how long did this... It's about 5 pages to hold in your hand. How many decades did it take for you to write this?
Well, it's one of those stories that defies most of my experiences with writing stories, which is that it came out very quickly. And I always hate hearing other writers say how quickly something came about, because it's a rare occurrence and you're always kind of full of envy for those moments. This is the, you know, one story that I think I've ever written in a day.
Really?
But,
wow.
But then, you know, the
revision
process
just not
definitely
fair.
Took time.
That, well.
Would you mind reading it for us? And we can talk more on the back end.
Okay, sure.
A history of everything, including you. First there was God, or gods, or nothing. Then synthesis, space, the expanse, explosions, implosions, particles, objects, combustion, and fusion. Out of the chaos came order. Stars were born and shone and died. Planets rolled across their galaxies on invisible ellipses, and the elements combined and became. Life evolved or was created. Cells trembled and divided and gasped and found dry land. Soon they grew legs and fins and hands and antenna and mouths and ears and wings and eyes. Eyes that opened wide to take all of it in, the creeping, growing, soaring, swimming, crawling, stampeding universe. Eyes opened and closed and opened again. We called it blinking. Above us shone a star that we called the sun. And we called the ground the earth. So we named everything, including ourselves. We were man and woman, and when we got lonely, we figured out a way to make more of us. We called it sex, and most people enjoyed it. We fell in love. We talked about God and banged stones together, made sparks and called them fire. We got warmer, and the food got better. We got married. We had some children. They cried and crawled and grew. One dissected flowers, sometimes eating the petals. Another liked to chase squirrels. We fought wars over money and honor and women. We starved ourselves. We hired prostitutes. We purified our water. We compromised, decorated, and became esoteric. One of us stopped breathing and turned blue. Then others. First we covered them with leaves, and then we buried them in the ground. We remembered them. We forgot them. We aged. Our buildings kept getting taller. We hired lawyers and formed councils and left paper trails. We negotiated. We admitted. We got sick and searched for cures. We invented lipstick, vaccines, Pilates, solar panels, interventions, table manners, firearms, window treatments, therapy, birth control, tailgating, status symbols, palimony, sportsmanship, focus groups, Zoloft, sunscreen, landscaping, Cessnas, fortune cookies, chemotherapy, convenience foods, and computers. We angered militants and our mothers. You were born. You learned to walk and went to school and played sports and lost your virginity and got into a decent college and majored in psychology and went to rock shows and became political and got drunk and changed your major to marketing and wore turtleneck sweaters and read novels and volunteered and went to movies and developed a taste for blue cheese dressing. I met you through friends and didn't like you at first. The feeling was mutual, but we got used to each other. We had sex for the first time behind an art gallery, standing up and slightly drunk. You held my face in your hands and said that I was beautiful. And you were too, tall, with a streetlight behind you. We went back to your place and listened to the White Album. We ordered in, we fought, and made up, and got good jobs, and got married, and bought an apartment, and worked out, and ate more, and talked less. I got depressed. You ignored me. I was sick of you. You drank too much and got careless with money. I slept with my boss. We went into counseling and got a dog. I bought a book of sex positions and we tried the least degrading one, the wheelbarrow. You took flight lessons and subscribed to Rolling Stone. I learned Spanish and started gardening. We had some children. who more or less disappointed us, but it might have been our fault. You were too indulgent and I was too critical. We loved them anyway. One of them died before we did, stabbed on the subway. We grieved. We moved. We adopted a cat. The world seemed uncertain. We lived beyond our means. I got judgmental and belligerent. You got confused and easily tired. You ignored me. I was sick of you. We forgave. We remembered. We made cocktails. We got tender. There was that time on the porch when you said, "Can you believe it?" This was near the end, and your hands were trembling. I think you were talking about everything, including us. Did you want me to say it so it would not be lost? It was too much for me to think about. I could not go back to the beginning. I said, "Not really," and we watched the sun go down. A dog kept barking in the distance, and you were tired, but you smiled and you said, "Hear that? It's rough, rough," and we laughed. You were like that. Now, your question is my project, and our house is full of clues. I'm reading old letters and turning over rocks. I bury my face in your sweaters. I study a photograph taken at the beach, the sun in our eyes and the water behind us. It's a victory to remember the forgotten picnic basket and your striped beach blanket. It's a victory to remember how the jellyfish stung you and you ran screaming from the water. It's a victory to remember dressing the wound with meat tenderizer and you saying, "I made it better." I will tell you this. Standing on our hill this morning, I looked at the land we chose for ourselves. I saw a few green patches and our sweet little shed. That same dog was barking. A storm was moving in. I did not think of heaven, but I saw that the clouds were beautiful, and I watched them cover the sun.
A History of Everything, Including You, by Jenny Hallowell.
Jenny, can you talk a little bit about, like, what you were thinking when you were writing this? Like, where did this come from?
Oh, the story kind of came from that impulse to kind of trace back. I think maybe I was in therapy at the time. And, you know, they always ask you about your parents or their parents. And I found myself a little frustrated by the idea that it's traceable, like whatever sort of position you find yourself in life, that you can trace back to the origin. You know, if you follow that logic, then you're eventually going to end up in a protoplasmic sort of situation. And I think that's
because on the couch, the guy said, "So tell me about your parents. Tell me about their parents. Tell me about their parents. Tell me about their parents." It's one of those kind of things.
Kind of. At some point, you're talking about some caveman's emotionally unavailable parents.
Hmm. And to imagine one of the conversations you might have had with your therapist. I know you were once very religious and then you've kind of lost your faith. I mean, was that part of this? Did that happen near or in the neighborhood of writing this story?
It was probably about 2 years before the writing of the story. But it was still a very fresh experience. I was sort of in the thick of it at the time.
And was there something of that struggle or fall from faith that kind of got infused into the storytelling?
I think so, too. I mean, I think that definitely is a part of, you know, the searching that I was going through at the time. Just that desire to grasp what might be the grand, you know, heart of it all. So the story was a little about that wrestling experience, trying to explain how I'm here, how we got here, how we ended up in this moment.
And the logic of that is having lost a given to you narrative of how things began, you were thinking, okay, so let me see if I can work my own narrative from the ground up?
That's definitely where I was, just sort of maybe mourning the loss of that narrative a little bit and making one of my own to just give me something to think about. I definitely don't feel like I stumbled across any solutions, but I felt like the comfort of narrative is definitely something I believe in, and the story sort of is a extension of my process about thinking about the beginning of everything.
Well, as creation stories go, it's really, really nice, I have to say. You're going to be hearing from Talmudic rabbis and Quranic scholars and Christian saints.
Have you ever thought about getting a church?
Start one of your own.
Wow, that's that feels like a can of worms, baby. But thank you.
Hi, this is Amanda calling from Syracuse, New York. Radiolab is produced by Jad Appenrad. Our staff includes Brenna Farrell, Ellen Horn, David Gable, Dylan Keefe, Matt Kelty, Lynn Levy, Andy Mills, Latif Nasser, Melissa O'Donnell, Kelsey Paget, Arian Weck, Molly Webster, Soren Wheeler, and Jamie York, with help from Damiano Marchetti, Molly McBride Jacobson, and Alexandra Lee Young.
Hi, this is Garrett Ward from Los Angeles. Our fact checkers are Eva Dasher and Michelle Harris. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Say bye. Bye. Radiolab is supported by Cozy Earth. When you think about summer comfort, words like breezy or soft maybe come to mind. With Cozy Earth's luxurious bedding and loungewear, you'll get the comfort of home wherever you roam, allowing you to elevate your summer getaway no matter where or even if you're getting away. Cozy Earth bedding is temperature regulating and made from top-notch materials, including viscose from bamboo that can turn any living or sleeping space into a sanctuary of luxury and comfort. Their loungewear and pajamas offer you their signature level of comfort while maintaining an elegant fit so you can look cute and be comfy even if you're taking a long flight or car trip. Cozy Earth provided an exclusive offer for Radiolab listeners. Get 35% off site-wide when you use the code Radiolab at www.cozyearth.com. That's 35% off at cozyearth.com, code Radiolab. Discover your next destination for ultimate comfort at Cozy Earth.